now we know what my dad looks at every time he wakes up and stuff.
Local miners can feel more at home at work. And fish fraud in the lower 48. It's the KHNS Local News. I'm Tara Bicknell. That news and more up next. The Haynesboro Assembly meets Tuesday to certify elections results. Residents have the option until close of business Tuesday to dispute the results from this month's election. No challenges have been filed at this time. They'll also continue discussions on junk management and off-premises signs as a conditional use, the kinds that direct traffic to businesses located a block or so away from where the sign sits. The Assembly will also consider the recommendation to appoint 5 new members to the newly developed Haynesport Development Steering Committee and to authorize the contracting of 4 entities for borough projects. A new ordinance is introduced to establish a public park at Picture Point. The law would be part of necessary steps to acquire the land, which is to be purchased through a grant awarded earlier this year from the Department of Transportation. The Borough Assembly meets in its regular meeting on Tuesday, October 25th at 6:30 p.m. in Assembly Chambers, located in the Public Safety Building. Southeast Alaska's Kensington Gold Mine will soon have permanent housing for almost 100 employees in an effort to make it easier to hire workers who don't live in Juneau. Jan Trigg, Manager of Community Relations and Government Affairs for the mine, explains it's something Southeast towns have wanted since before the mine was built in 2007.
Yeah, this is one thing that's been a long-standing request by communities in Southeast Alaska, including Haines, and what it allows for is to provide options and work schedules for employees that live in our neighboring communities.
Trigg made the announcement personally to Haines Mayor Jan Hill and the Haines Chamber of Commerce at Southeast Conference, and in a phone call to Haines Assemblyman Scott Rossman, who's been a campaigner for more local hire at the mine.
Well, he'd been a real advocate for, you know, looking out for Haines, and so I wanted to make sure that he was aware that we'd move forward with something that he had been an advocate for and requested.
Right now, there's a temporary 120-person facility at the mine located 35 air miles south of Haines, plus other tents and makeshift dorms. The largest temporary building will now be considered permanent, and the new 96-person facility will replace the other temporary rooms. Permanent housing is meant to make time off easier on those employees who do not have homes in Juneau.
So it's a definite improvement for both our, you know, our employees and our contractors at site.
The current setup works well for employees based in Juneau, the other terminal for transport to Kensington, but not so much for those who have to travel from further away. That was an issue that Haynesboro pointed out back when Core Alaska, operators of Kensington, came to local governments for their declared support. Trigg says diversifying employment is something the company is interested in. Almost 1.5 years after commercial production began at the mine, they're making that promise visible.
Core Alaska remains committed to local hire and just felt it was important to make it possible for our Southeast neighbors to be a part of our Kensington family.
Materials for the new housing arrived last week, and the company estimates the middle to end of December for completion of the permanent housing. The mine is the second largest private employer in Juneau in terms of payroll, employing 200 workers during operations. A few of the working families that live in our little towns don't actually work in our little towns. Some of your neighbors work in far-flung places from the other side of the planet to the Marine Highway or the nearby mines. For those family members who see off mostly dads and husbands every few weeks for another shift at remote mines like Kensington and Greens Creek, it's hard to imagine what life is like when they're at work. That's why Family Day at Southeast Alaska's Greens Creek Mine was such a popular trip for some local kids who have relatives working there.
We wanted to see what our dad did when he was gone for 2 weeks.
And we didn't get to see him, but we almost did, and we saw 5 deer, 6.
Gable and his older brother Hudson got to visit their dad, James, at Greens Creek for Family Day this fall. They talked about the trip one day during lunch at Haines School.
We got to go underground and see the mill and do a lot of fun things there.
It's called a boom. And we got to run that and drill rocks.
It's really fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had to wear hard hats and glasses and white jacket for like underground and at the mill.
It took a 35-minute boat ride with mostly Haines and Juneau families to get there. The mines located between Juneau and Hoonah and mines.
Zinc and lead.
The boys described seeing breaching whales and heavy machinery on their trip and were equally impressed with both ends of that spectrum, enjoying both pristine Alaskan wildlife and industrial processing equipment.
And we got to feel the weights, and we got to feel metal, like stuff, and my dad dumps that, and it goes through a reveller or something, whatever it's called, and it dumps, and it has a really cool light when it's doing it. It goes, and it's red, and we got to walk on a crate, and it's a long fall down, and we got to look down through the holes. It was scary. We see a lot more deer because my dad sees like 10 a day.
Hudson was surprised that the zinc and lead that came out of the process was so soft and how they got so much heavy equipment over there. He said his favorite part was going underground in a little buggy.
Gable and Ashlyn were sitting up front and me and Clay were in the back standing up. And then on the way up, it was like so windy because they're pushing all the air down there. And it was really fun.
Like a moving sign. And it's really cool. And the wind, and we got to shut off the lights and see how dark it was. I couldn't even see my hand.
They checked out the crusher, water sprayer, conveyor belts, underground dump trucks, and recalled it with precise description. They both thought it would be a cool job to work there.
Because you can drive trucks and you see a lot of deer and you see a lot of bears and that stuff. And you're going to drive a lot of off-road equipment.
Although the boys didn't get to see their dad while they were there, Hudson said the trip made it easier to talk to his dad about work when he was home.
Now we know what my dad looks at every time he wakes up and stuff.
We got to see his truck and then we got to see his apartment where he stays.
But for Gable, it wasn't the boat ride, the underground buggy, or the larger-than-life machinery that impressed him the most.
That was my first year.
That was Hudson and Gable Sage from Haines talking about their family day trip to Greens Creek Mine in southern Southeast Alaska.
He's out there and he's like, for every deer I see, I'll give you $1. And so we would be pointing him out to him and we'd be like, oh, there's a deer.
Can you give me
like,
that guy?
Yeah, there's a deer. And then, but we never did see a bear. So.
Some seafood sold in the Pacific Northwest isn't what it seems. Mislabeled fish is more common than you might think, according to the few cops trying to make sure people get the species they paid for. Now, those who are on patrol are looking for higher penalties to deter fish cheaters. Northwest News Network correspondent Tom Bonsi reports from Seattle.
Washington Fish and Wildlife Officer Eric Olson trained to become a game warden, but his job has also turned him into a seafood connoisseur.
Yeah, see that spot pattern?
Uh-huh.
See how it's just one after another? See that? It's just...
Made of corn?
Yeah, that is not...
On a recent morning, Olson drops in unannounced at the seafood counters of half a dozen stores and markets in Seattle.
Nice.
He's on the lookout for misbranded fish, which he can sometimes spot with the naked eye. Other times, it takes a lot more sleuthing.
It's kind of hard when it doesn't have the head on it and everything else.
Funny business on the label is also a tip-off. At an Asian market, the manager gets a gentle scolding for omissions.
I know that it's probably farm-raised, okay, Atlantic salmon, but you need to actually say that on there.
Oh,
okay.
So say on the label, you're saying?
Correct.
Okay,
on the label that actually, so the consumer can make an informed decision.
Olson could write a ticket, but the contrite manager gets off with a verbal warning. The officer saves his ire for bigger fish, you might say.
Quite honestly, all this stuff is always about the money, always about the bottom line.
The ill-gotten profit comes from misbranding farmed salmon as more expensive wild-caught, or swapping among species, say, sockeye for king, or a switcheroo like cheap imported Greenland turbot for Pacific halibut. Those are all examples of ripoffs that state or federal agents have busted in this region.
Can you get the manager for me?
Olson figures about 15% of seafood in the marketplace is masquerading as something other than what it actually is. His is in the middle range of various estimates. For the past 3 years, a University of Washington Tacoma environmental scientist has assigned students to run DNA tests on salmon sold at retail and in South Puget Sound restaurants. Professor Erica Klein says more than a third, 38% of the restaurant samples came back as a different species than what the menu said.
So that was the really high
Shocker.
By contrast, Klein says the vast majority of tested grocery stores were honest.
You know, there could be a number of things going on there. I think grocery stores probably are mostly larger chains and are pretty heavily scrutinized.
Klein says once a fillet is cooked and sauced in a restaurant, it's hard to prove fraud without a DNA test. Klein says when she dines out, she asks about where the fish came from. If she gets a dodgy answer, she orders something else. In Washington State, the deputy chief of the Fish and Wildlife Police is looking for a legislator who will champion higher penalties. Mike Sensi says seafood mislabeling is currently a misdemeanor with a maximum $200 fine for the first offense.
If you're at a retail level and you've got a mislabeled package or two, that might be enough deterrent. But if you're dealing in tens of thousands of dollars in seafood products, major fraud involved there, that would more than be the cost of doing business. That's not a disincentive to discontinue that kind of practice or fraud.
The feds will sometimes throw the book at big-time bait-and-switchers. Sensi separately has to stave off budget cuts to the few cops on this beat. In Salem, a state police lieutenant says Oregon Fish and Wildlife troopers have the authority, but rarely the time, to conduct inspections for misbranding. Earlier this year, a report from the conservation group Oceana called the national enforcement effort against fish fraud virtually non-existent. I'm Tom Bonsi in Seattle.
For KHNS, I'm Tara Bicknell.